Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you around the world, and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're a regular listener, thank you for joining me once again. If this is your first time, please make yourself at home as we bring you Answers for the Family. And if you like what you hear, please let your friends know how to find us, because each week this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. And speaking of top professionals, Dr. Matt Polacek will be back with us next week as our co-host. I believe he's taking a much-needed vacation, and I wish him all the success and a great time with his family. Now, before we get to our guest, could you use a clear, succinct, and effective tips for managing issues about cell phones, rewards, homework, or meltdowns? Are you a parent of school-aged or tween kids feeling like there's no balance between setting healthy limits and having fun with your kids? Are you sick of getting freebies that don't really give you the strategies you need to see that really bring you long-lasting change in your child? Well, if any of that sounds like you, you're not alone. Many parents struggle to find the right balance to effective parenting strategies that lead to long-lasting change in their child's behavior while not sacrificing their relationship with their child. So, I want to tell you about something that starts this week, because during the next 7 days, there will be a 7-day parenting challenge, and you will get 7 days of videos that will make you feel less guilty, less stressed, much more confident at wielding your parenting powers, and it will cover such issues as how to find out what happened in your child's day without actually getting a shrug-shoulder answer, guiding your child to healthy social media usage, getting to the bottom of the homework battle, and so much other things. So again, when this show is over, check this out. Go to theparentingskill.com. Again, it is free. It is a 7-day parenting challenge. There are a variety of guests of each on each of these videos. I was honored to be one of them. So as you're listening to them, and I don't remember which day mine is, but you'll also get to see me on there as well. So now let's get to today's topic. Our topic today, which is also the title of our guest's new book, is Life on the Rocks: Finding Meaning in Addiction and Recovery. It's a book that provides a unique take on addiction and recovery through the words and views of philosophers as well as her own experiences. By drawing upon the wisdom of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, to name just a few, while illuminating issues addicts and their loved ones face, such as self-identity, moral responsibility, self-knowledge, self-deception, free will, fatalism, the nature of God, and their relations to others. So joining us is the author of this fascinating book, Peg O'Connor. Peg is a professor of philosophy and gender, women, and sexuality studies at Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota. She writes the popular Psychology Today blog, Philosophy Stirred, Not Shaken, with over 375,000 unique hits to her 34 posts to date, and is the featured columnist for ProTalks, part of the Rehab.com online community of addiction treatment specialists. Her previous books include Morality and Our Complicated Form of Life and Oppression and Responsibility. Peg, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thanks for having me, Alan. I'm really excited to be here with you and to have some fun conversation, lively conversation. This is great.
Well, I'm looking forward to it as well. And the first thing that struck me when I started reading the book is, I mean, how or why did you discover this link between philosophy and drug taking?
I didn't so much discover the link as I lived the link. So I am a philosopher by training. My training is in primarily moral philosophy, and I've been a teacher now for 20 years, and I'm also a recovering alcoholic. But my link between philosophy and addiction goes back to my own undergraduate days. I was one of those people who started using early in high school, and my use escalated and escalated. By the time I got to college, I was a full-blown raging alcoholic, and somehow I got through college where simultaneously I fell in love with philosophy while nearly drinking myself to death, and then I sobered up not long after college. So I discovered made the link between philosophy and addiction because I was trying to live my own life, and I was trying to figure out who the heck I am and why was I doing the things I was doing? Why was I self-sabotaging? You know, I had all these career goals and aspirations and dreams, and yet I was undermining myself at every turn, and I didn't really know how to stop drinking. And I certainly tried stopping a whole bunch of times and never succeeded. And I thought, wow, what is going on here? And I was studying philosophy, and I happened to find frameworks to help me ask good questions to figure out who I wanted to be and what was I willing to do and how was I going to get there.
Now, was there a couple of specific things that was sort of the catalyst at that point to where you went, wait a minute, I better start looking at this a little more from a philosophical standpoint?
I needed to start looking at it. I knew this in high school. I was one of those kids who had that little voice, or the little voice that, you know, had one of those whisper shouts yelling, you've got a problem, you've got a problem, you've got a problem. And so I'll out myself here as a 50-year-old. In the early 1980s, we didn't think really that there were teen addicts. We really didn't have that framework for making sense of what kids were doing. And we all, I think, operated with an assumption that, oh, the alcoholic, we had a very male model in mind, certainly not a female, certainly not a young woman. And I think I was kind of, because I didn't fit the mold of alcoholic, I don't think that people, you know, my parents sure as heck didn't know what to do with me, and getting in trouble at school didn't help. But that little voice was there, and that little voice kept getting amplified. And one of the first places where I encountered a discussion about drunkenness is in the philosopher Aristotle. So Aristotle was probably writing this around 350 BCE. And he talked about the ways in which people who are drunk, the ways in which they are still responsible for their actions in some sense, even if they don't remember them, even if they don't sort of know everything that went into making that decision, that they still bear responsibility. And that got me thinking. And another way that people talk about addiction is somehow involving a weakness of will, that either we are weak in our will such that we always give in to temptation, we put our desires or our cravings over everything, and that we oftentimes know that we shouldn't do something, and yet we do, the kind of classic yeah, but thinking. And I saw Aristotle talking about that yeah, but thinking, and I thought, oh my gosh, that is so me. Yeah, I know I should stop, but... And living a yeah-but life is exhausting. So that's where I first kind of ran into philosophy and addiction.
Well, from a philosophical point of view, where does medicating oneself fall morally?
You know, it really depends. Because people use for all different kinds of reasons. I mean, you know, in general, I don't think a lot of us think there's anything wrong with someone who doesn't have a problem drinking, for example, you know, says, my gosh, I just want to go home and have a beer or two, and I want to unwind. I mean, a lot of us think, well, yeah, that's totally a healthy thing to do. You got to let off some steam. You got to just relax. You've got to, you know, loosen up the reins some. That's perfectly okay. For me, it's always interesting to try to figure out, when does something that is harmless or just kind of fun, when does it characters start to change, such that it's a little more harmful, or it's now carrying something of a cost, and maybe it's becoming use is becoming misuse. I mean, I think there are all kinds of ways in which people can use legal drugs in a totally fine, morally permissible kind of way. It gets more interesting when you start talking about, say, something like marijuana. What a great discussion to have with, so I'm at a college in the state of Minnesota where recreational marijuana isn't legal. And to talk to my students about the fact that, look, it's not legal and it is still addictive and it isn't harmless like a lot of young people think that it is. And yet, you know, they equate it with alcohol and they think, you know, we're in college, we should get to do this. And I say, well, you know, what's the should there? Yeah, should you get to do it? Well, you shouldn't get to break the law. But, you know, when you're 21 and you decide, oh my gosh, I've been studying for these exams, I deserve to drink. I always listen to how people describe the reasons why they drink. And when I hear someone say, I deserve to drink, that sometimes sets off a little warning bell for me.
Yeah. Oh, I would agree. Now, I mean, what's your take now from the standpoint, I mean, governments are legalizing it, I mean, all over the world, and especially from state to state here in the United States. Mm-hmm. What do you think the reasoning is behind that, and where do you think it's going to take us?
I think part of the reasoning has to do with trying to offer something of a correction to the ways in which marijuana has been criminalized and the number of people who have been doing a lot of seat time in prison for the possession of marijuana. I think there's something of an overcorrection now to say, well, then let's therefore just decriminalize it. And, you know, it's interesting when you look at medical marijuana, because there were such constraints on when and how it could be grown and examined for medicinal use, we actually don't have a lot of good evidence for its effectiveness for use in medical situations. And a lot of the evidence that is being cited is more anecdotal. I'm always worried about, you know, our laws here may be getting ahead of the science. Not that I think that science should always carry the day. I think we need to proceed with caution. I think it will become legalized, recreational marijuana, and I think there need to be some pretty sharp constraints put on its accessibility, and I think we need to prepare for a whole host of challenges that we don't know anything about. I mean, Colorado, for example, they have no clue how to test for impaired driving with someone who's been smoking marijuana. And we know you can be impaired from marijuana, but how do you – it's not like you can blow in a breathalyzer.
Yeah, that's a great point. I didn't know that they were having that particular problem. So where do we take that from the standpoint of – there's a lot of information out there from the standpoint of medicinal value. So on the one hand, you have the medicinal value. Like most anything else, even prescription drugs, they can all be abused. So
yes,
at that point, it sounds like we're getting closer to personal responsibility.
Personal responsibility will always factor in somewhere. But I don't – our ways in U.S. culture of talking about responsibility are so thin and kind of beige. A lot of times people think responsibility is the exact same thing as being blameworthy. So this is where my training as a moral philosopher comes out, that there's so much more to responsibility than just blaming someone. Responsibility certainly looks backwards, you know, what I've done and what I was doing, what I was thinking of, and it looks at the present. How am I now? But it also, responsibility looks to the future. How am I going to be? How am I going to do things differently? And I think it's totally appropriate to talk about personal responsibility when it comes down to someone decides to get sober and they've got to figure out how they're going to be able to do that. And people need to be able to say, yes, I did all of these things. And every choice that we make isn't voluntary or on par with the same kind of choice. Do I want a Diet Coke with my sandwich, or do I want a Diet Pepsi with my sandwich? That choices are constrained in all kinds of ways. And a lot of the discussions I read about responsibility in addiction seem to make it appear that all choices are on par with one another, and that therefore responsibility is you've either got complete responsibility or you've got no responsibility. Like responsibility is a toggle switch. And when you take a look at the ways in which choices are always constrained by, you know, the realities of the situation, by the context, by the circumstances, you know, it's true. If you're caught between a rock and a hard place and you have to act, you will act. But if both options are really, really bad, it might make sense why you might choose one over the other. And so for me, when I take a look at the ways that different addictions develop and the different reasons why people start to use and misuse, it seems there are a lot of people looking to escape, that a lot of people are incredibly stressed, and a lot of people are self-medicating untreated or undiagnosed mental health issues. And that's a systemic problem. That's a public health problem that we've got.
Well, and going along those lines, we have a instant message coming in, and this one reads, in a study published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, it was stated that genetics can play a part in addictive behavior. The statement was made that addiction is due in part 50% to genetic predisposition and 50% to poor coping skills. I'd like to know your thoughts about this.
Well, I would question the, how would you even begin to calculate a 50-50 split of what are contributing factors there? I have no doubt that there are some kind of genetic components to addiction. I have no doubt that addiction is quite importantly a biochemical condition, but addiction is just as much a psychological and a social problem. So, for example, you can say this type of person or this person has a genetic predisposition to X, Y, and Z. Name any traits that you want. Mm-hmm. Those traits still are always expressed within an environment. And why is it that some environments act as triggers or they switch on genetic expression? That, to me, is the really interesting question. Because addiction is such a complicated set of phenomena, I always worry about trying to say, and this is really the original source or cause of addiction. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, human beings are not just biochemical things in the world. We are people standing in social relations. We are experiencing beings. We have feelings. We have emotions. We have beliefs. We have values. And all of those are part and parcel. So however we talk about addiction, we have to take in all the different dimensions of it. And when we don't, that's when I think we start to run into some problems when we think about how ought it to be treated then.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a great point, because I know some of the studies that I've seen done with twins where they were separated at birth and raised in completely different environments, and you have one who may have an addiction issue and one who has not dealt with any addiction issues their entire life, and they were brought back together 30, 40, 50 years later. So, I think it's interesting that – you know, how much of this is environment? How much of this is genetics? I don't know that there's I agree with you. I don't know that there's a set answer, just that it has some influence. We just don't know to what degree.
Mm-hmm. But putting so much weight on the genetic part of it has implications for addiction research. So the National Institute of Health, for example, has changed some of their requirements to receive funding for research into, say, something like mental illness or addiction, where now the focus is all and only minus about 2%, so nearly all and only on looking for genetic markers. So if you've got a research program that tries to take a look at the interaction between genetic markers and these social and economic considerations and circumstances, you're probably not going to get funded. And what that does is it's going to prioritize one kind of research over and above all elders. And I'm going to keep coming back to one of the ways that we've started talking about addiction now is that the brain is addicted, that the brain is the organ that is addicted. And for me, with my experience, I was not in the world as an addicted brain. I was in the world as an addicted person, and I am not my brain. So the feminist in me always worries about objectification. What happens when you reduce someone to a body part? And feminists have done great work on what happens when you reduce a woman to being, you know, a pair of legs or a nice, can I say the word ass if I'm referring
sure.
to a body part?
Sure.
Okay, or a nice ass versus, you know, saying, well, addicts are just these addicted brains. And to me, that's a crazy picture of what a person is. But that's the language that is starting to swamp the terrain in addiction studies. And for me, and in my work, I want to keep pulling it back to taking a look at the experiences and the sense we're able to make of those experiences of addiction, because human beings are meaning-making beings. We experience and we make meaning.
Well, what are some of the specific philosophers? In other words, are there specific philosophers that you found that brought a certain type of information in? So in other words, I think as you were saying that, I was thinking that any type of research is going to be slanted a little bit towards the subject matter that they're looking at. And so as you said, if they're looking for genetic markers, they're not really going to find any social reasons why this is happening. So did you find the same thing with some of the philosophers, that based on what their philosophy was, it brought us to a particular view of addiction?
So one of my favorite philosophers is the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. He lived from 1888 until 1952, I think it is. I'm terrible at dates. And one of the things that he wrote goes something like this. We feel as if, even if all possible scientific questions could be answered, the problems of life remain completely untouched. And that really, in some ways, authorized me, it inspires me to continue to resist a completely biological, genetic, reductionist account of addiction. Because you can talk to many addicts and say, here's what happens when you drink a lot of alcohol. This part of your brain, that neurotransmitter dopamine, gets all fired up and it floods out in there and you're in this little realm of euphoria, but then it starts going away and then it turns out you need more and more of the alcohol to hit that same level of dopamine flowing through you that gives you that kind of euphoria. You can explain all that to many addicts, and many addicts might say, yeah, I agree there's something biological here, but that does not at all touch the experience of when I reach that point of intoxication where I feel the stress just disappear from my life, or when I take that, you know, toke on, you know, with marijuana, I suddenly just feel this instant release and I feel more mellow. So Wittgenstein really helps me to think about the ways in which science has a lot to offer, but they don't have everything to offer. And Wittgenstein also has been very instrumental for me, in helping to understand why it is that some worldviews, or why it is that what people do over in one part of the world may make no sense to those of us over in another part of the world. So, for example, I oftentimes hear people who have never struggled with addiction say, I just can't understand how he would risk losing his job, his family, his house, his career, in order to keep using or to keep gambling. I just can't make sense of that. How could he do that? Why doesn't he just stop? And then when you talk to many other addicts, so, you know, those are the non-addicts saying, I just can't understand, and talk to other people who have struggled with their own addictions, they'll say, yeah, I get that crazy way of thinking. There's a certain mm-hmm. kind of logic there that I can follow because I share it. One of the subjects that Wittgenstein spent a lot of time on was how do people in those two different groups come to make sense to one another? And that's really important that they do, because when you take a look at, so, you know, your show is mm-hmm. Answers for the Family. I mean, addiction is something that strikes individuals, yes, but it also strikes families. So what do you do if you've got one parent who's really active in his or her addiction and wife, partner, husband can't figure out why she keeps doing this and why, you know, these things keep happening? What happens when you can't make sense of the people with whom you are in the most intimate and dependent kind of relationship with? So Wittgenstein gave me a lot to think about there too, about the ways in which the sense I'm able to make very much depends upon my being with other people who are able to make the same kind of sense with me.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking about, as you were saying that, and we transport at-risk youth to specialized programs, many of which are going to drug and alcohol rehab centers. And,
right.
and one in particular was a parent who we give a script, we tell them what to say, and it's usually very limited. You know, we love you very much, and you know, and then we dismiss the parents so that it doesn't become, you know, how can I push the parents' button so that we can keep this from happening? Well, in one particular situation I was thinking about, the parent said, I just don't understand this. The child said, why are you sending me to this place? And the parent said, because I just don't understand why you can't quit. Why, if you could just quit, I don't understand. And the child said, try quitting breathing.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. to their parent, and their parent just went white. I mean, literally all the blood rushed out of their head. And the child said, it's the only way I can explain it to you. You don't have this same feeling towards a drug as I do. But to me, I feel like it's the same as breathing. And I mean, that at the time, you know, was, mm-hmm. you know, it was really telling, you know, for someone.
Powerful. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was the first time in which that parent really understood what their child was going through. But at the same time, what I felt was the parent also then went into this place within themselves of thinking, I know I'm doing the right thing now. Because I think that the reason that they were still there and why they hadn't kind of moved out when we were dismissing them was they still just felt guilt. They felt like they weren't sure about what they were doing. But at that moment, the parent listened. Again, they turned white and they just turned and they walked out. They said, I love you very much. And they turned and walked out. So, you know, maybe for some people, I mean, they need to hear it in that respect.
I think they do. And, you know, my heart aches for parents with adolescents who are struggling with addiction, because the best parents in the world always want to do the good, right things by their children, that they want to cherish them. They want to protect them. And then as a young person is becoming addicted, when you layer that onto all the developmental changes that they're undergoing, the hormonal changes they're undergoing, oh my gosh, you've got a perfect storm.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, where do you, you know, what functions as a safe harbor when you've got that perfect storm out there? And kids oftentimes cannot understand that a parent or another adult may have their best interest at heart. Oftentimes they can't understand that. And so mm-hmm. to try to explain that, I mean, there's that chasm of being incomprehensible. You know, the young kid might not understand, how can my parents do this to me? And the parent can't understand, why can't you just stop?
Well,
and
you
land in that spot and you've got big trouble.
Yeah, you're so on target from the standpoint of what the child is thinking, because so often that's what we end up hearing. You know, we hear mm-hmm. from the child, you know, why are you doing this? I can't believe that you're doing this. And in many cases, they'll start to vent in a very angry way. And from our standpoint, our situation with them is we're explaining to them, please understand that your parents are doing this out of love. You can hate the deed that is happening, but the decision to do this was very, very difficult and was made out of love. And I think that's one of the first steps, is to be able to split those two things so that they understand mm-hmm. that the person is not the deed. Because when they say they hate the deed, I'm going to hate my parents for life. It's two separate things. And splitting that is, I think, a good, one of the best steps as far as them, you know, as they go away to a program where they're going to deal with some of their own addictive issues.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully they'll be able to start drawing that distinction themselves. But, you know, developmentally, the ability to see the difference between short-term and long-term, that, you know, that doesn't happen until well into the teenage years. So if you've got a really young addict, if you've got someone, you know, who's 13 or 14, they can't mm-hmm. get there yet. So the only thing they have on their visual field is that short term, and why are you sending me away? Why are you taking me from my friends? Why? And I can't believe that more parents don't buckle under that pressure, because I can imagine that parents second guess themselves all the time when it comes to the decision to put their child into treatment. Because no one wants to believe that an adolescent can be an addict, even though they can. You know, no one wants to believe.
Yeah, that. Yeah. But you're absolutely right, and you're right. The parents, in many cases, do go through a variety of times in which they will buckle, or they will, mm-hmm. you know, they'll change their mind, or they'll allow their buttons to be pushed. And unfortunately, in some cases, then something after that happens that is catastrophic. Before they realize that I need to make this decision, I need to help them, mm-hmm. even if at this point in time they're going to say that they, you know, that they're going to hate me or whatever. It is one of the most heart-wrenching situations to be in when you're there with the child and with the parent. Oh, well, we're going to take a break. We're going to come right back. And on that note, the topic and the name of the book fits perfectly with what we're talking about. It's called Life on the Rocks, Finding Meaning in Addiction and Recovery. Stay with us. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest today is Peg O'Connor, and her book is Life on the Rocks, Finding Meaning in Addiction and Recovery. Now, if you're at your desk and you want to open up another window or just learn a little bit how to follow Peg or how to get more information, you can go to one website is centralrecoverypress.com. I said, or you can go to psychologytoday.com/experts/Peg O'Connor-PhD, and you can hear or you can read some of her various writings and stuff. If you just have a little bit of time, if you don't have time to read the whole book, well, you can still learn a little bit about some of her posts and what she's doing to really tie in this concept of taking wisdom from very, very well-known philosophers and applying it to today and applying it to the issues and addictions that our young people are dealing with today, and not just young people, everybody. So now with that, I wanted to also say we have another comment that has come in. This one comes in from, let's see, it didn't, oh, yes, from Henry As a psychologist, I also share the belief that taking responsibility and finding meaning in one's life is critical to one's recovery. When I first read that you were going to be on Alan's show, I did a little internet research, and what I read was so intriguing that I purchased the book. I am 2/3 of the way through it and loving it. Please know that I will be sharing it with fellow practitioners and my clients, as it is much more than just another book on addiction recovery. It is a beautifully written resource of inspiration that can be applied to all manner of life and life's challenges. Well done. And this is from Henry M. in Chicago.
Oh my, Henry M. Oh, I love you. You're my biggest fan. Oh, that's incredibly generous and very validating, because the book is written for a general audience. It's not written for pointy-headed PhDs in philosophy. It is written for anyone who has ever asked themselves any kind of question about who I am, what am I responsible for, what kind of sense do I make of my life, how do I understand my suffering. Oh, wow, I'm blown away by Henry's comments.
So one of the things that I know that you discuss in the book is, you know, some of your thoughts on psychedelics. Share with us a little bit about some of your thoughts on psychedelics. Again, I read some of it in the book, but I thought it was very interesting, a little bit about what your perspective is.
Well, different types of drugs affect different parts of the brain or affect different neurotransmitters. And people use the drugs that they use because they're looking for certain sorts of highs. And I think people who smoke marijuana or heroin, that those tend to have that super calming effect. I mean, they just kind of, it gives you a certain kind of euphoria that other things like stimulants, you know, they just make you feel so alive, like someone has just flipped your master circuit and you are just, boom, lit up like nothing before. And psychedelic drugs are really interesting and the effects that they have on people. And, you know, psychedelic drugs have had some uses in religious ceremonies, the idea that it kind of takes you out of this common, ordinary, present reality, and that you can see a different reality or see this reality in such different ways that, you know, it's not surprising that perhaps certain forms of mysticism have involved the use of psychedelics. But like any drugs, I mean, we in general don't talk about peyote as being used in addictive kind of ways when it's used in religious ceremonies, even if it's used religiously. But when you start talking about, you know, the magic mushrooms and things like that, where we've got more stereotypes of, you know, who are using them and why they're looking to use them, it seems more to go back to a comment you raised earlier about a kind of escapism or a kind of novelty as well. Any drugs can be dangerous. Psychedelic drugs, I think, seem to have more of a kind of rebounding effect, or you feel the effects of them for longer. And that's always worrisome. If you take a drug and you think the effects have worn off, and then, you know, even a day later, you're still having effects, that can be really disarming, dangerous.
Definitely. Now, there was a time, and you mentioned how old you are, and I'm in your same general area. You remember Timothy Leary, and he presented
he presented
the argument that psychedelics can help open the mind and help you see things from a different perspective. What's your thoughts on some of his, I guess, preachings might be the best way to describe it, or his theories back then?
I think there's something accurate in what he says. I mean, that the use of psychedelics means that you both literally and metaphorically see the world differently. And you might notice things that you've never noticed before, or you might look at the same thing you've been looking at the entire time and see it in a different way. You know, sometimes I think of those, they call magic eye puzzles that have all the geometric shapes and designs on them, and then you stare at them long enough and a picture emerges, you know, whether
yes.
it's a face or, you know, an animal or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think psychedelic drugs can be like that for some people. However, big however there, you don't have any control about what that experience is going to be like. And in general, the effects of the psychedelic drugs, there seems to be large variation in them. And that's where I get worried that, you know, the Timothy Learys of the world, I worry. What can I say? I'm a worrier.
Yeah, I was in Amsterdam some years ago, and one of the speakers that we had was the drug czar for that country. And it was very interesting in regards to his approach. And he said that at one time he was the Timothy Leary of his country. So I thought that was very interesting. Now, what their approach was, and even though he had some interesting comments about psychedelics, his approach was still the fact that they have legalized marijuana, they have legalized hash, they have made it incredibly more difficult to get any of the harder drugs. So, for instance, he said that they tax it heavily, and they use the money to have rehabilitation programs. Mm-hmm. But if you use something like cocaine or heroin, it's a minimum 10 years in jail. And he said so. Their theory is that if we give our population something, but not everything, that they'll look at the 10 years and say it just isn't worth it. And his explanation was, that it's proven out because they have a very small addiction issue as it relates to things like heroin, cocaine, or psychedelics. But they have a large amount of use as it relates to marijuana and hashish. Mm-hmm. So what's your thoughts on that country's approach to their drug issues?
Mm-hmm. And Portugal did something similar in decriminalizing a lot of drugs. I think there could be something to it. I mean, I think, clearly there is something to it. It's been working in Amsterdam. I acknowledge that. I'm just so curious what it would look like to try to put that into play when we can't even do that with marijuana, where it seems that whether it's because the United States is so big, we have such incredible geographic variations. I'd be really curious to see what it would be like to try to start conversations like that on a national level and sort of against this presidential primary season. I can't even imagine what that would look like. But I do think we need to start doing some things differently. Uh-huh. I mean, it's absolutely right that the war on drugs has been, in many ways, an abject failure. And it has had, so many unintended consequences and has criminalized so many people and destroyed so many people's lives. It's absolutely right to try to undo that. Now, what to do in its place, I feel out of my league in answering that because maybe it's because I'm a moral philosopher and, don't study con law all that much. I just am so curious how that would look.
All right. Well, let's go back to the philosophy side of this then. If you're talking to a group of parents and the parents are now concerned about their own children, how would you tell them in regards to philosophy and how it can help them communicate with their kids and hopefully keep them from going down that road?
Mm-hmm. One of the things I would talk a lot about would be friendship. And this comes from Aristotle. Aristotle says the right kinds of friends are necessary for living the best possible life and for flourishing. And having the right friends makes you be a better person because you've got more opportunity to develop your character and to acquire more virtues. And one of the things we know about adolescents who using in high schools and in college is very much of a social activity. I mean, are there some kids who drink alone by themselves or pregame more? They're more socially awkward. Yeah, it is. But drinking in particular is a very social activity. And I know that adolescents are oftentimes very sensitive with their parents about who their friends are, and that their friends are, you know, the subject of all kinds of parental scorn. Like, I don't want you hanging around with that girl, or I don't want you hanging around with that boy. But it's always really interesting to ask sort of what good things friends are giving each other. What benefit are they getting from the relationship? Because the other thing that we know, with the incredible uptick in the amount of ADHD diagnoses that are made and the readily available sources of ADHD medications, all of which are amphetamines, that it's friends who are sharing their drugs with their friends, and that friends are suggesting to the point of pressuring their friends who don't have a diagnosis and who don't use the drugs to try the drugs. And so, you know, as a parent, I'd want to have conversations about, you know, who are your friends, and what do you do? What are you getting from this relationship? And they make you be a better person? Do you feel happier with them? Because I know when I talk with my college students, and, you know, we've got some students here and students everywhere who are trying not to drink, who, you know, have gotten into some kind of trouble. And what they find really hard is that they're afraid of losing their friends. And they also have some friends who are saying to them, oh, come on, you can go out. Don't worry. You're not going to get caught. No, you're not going to get caught and suspended. And the question is, what kind of friend is someone who's encouraging you to engage in something that would have a really significant negative impact on you? You could get kicked out of school. That's not helping you to be a better person. So I'd want to talk about the friends and the sociality of drinking and drug using, to try to figure out sort of what needs do these kids think they have that their friends are filling while using alcohol and drugs. I think that's really crucial. And I think I'd also want to talk about, I think, you know, boys and girls, they start to drink differently for all kinds of gendered reasons. I mean, you'd have to tailor a conversation, you know, with young men. If I were the parent to a 14-year-old boy, I would want to have a lot of conversations about masculinity and that whole notion of drinking like a man and man up, and the ways in which, you know, getting drunk and drinking alcohol and getting drunk are kind of regarded as a rite of passage, particularly for young men, and that young men really do encourage each other, and in part because they take on expectations that, you know, they've got to drink in order to fit in. And, you know, that's a certain set of reasons for drinking or using that as a parent I would want to be very clear with my son about. And with daughters tend to drink more because of low self-esteem and wanting to fit in. And one of the things that we know about how different ADHD is in girls from boys, ADHD in girls tends to manifest itself in more internally directed ways. So more anxiety, more low self-esteem. And I think a lot of adolescent girls start drinking because they don't feel good about themselves for a whole bunch of reasons. They're not popular enough. They're too fat. They're too skinny. They're too short. They've got the wrong color hair. I mean, all these sorts of things, because adolescents drinking and drugging is so tied up with how they see themselves in relationship to others. And bottom line is, I'd want to know who the comparison pool is for my kid in measuring herself and saying that she is failing or is a loser, or my son is saying, you know, I don't want to be regarded as a sissy or as something like that.
Well, Peg, I just want to tell you, I appreciate it so much. I want to acknowledge you for not only talking about your own situation, but for really going out and gathering the information that was out there. It was out there. These philosophers had it out there. You took the time to gather it and to put it together and to provide it in an excellent book for everybody to read. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan, for the kind words.
Well, and again, I would love to have you back. There's so much more that I think that we could touch on these subjects, but unfortunately, we're out of time. So again, for everybody else out there, you know, If you want to get the book, it's called Life on the Rocks, Finding Meaning in Addiction and Recovery. If you're driving and you can't write any of this stuff down, go to our site, go to the Answers for the Family site. We'll have all of this information. So Peg, again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan. It's been a real pleasure. And keep doing your good work, keeping kids safe.
And thank you. And for everybody out there, tune in next week when our guest will be Kelly Holland, author of Primary Gift, Experience the Excellence of Your Life's Journey. And if you missed or you want to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com or check us out and subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher. And the next time that you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check out some of our latest posts. And if you like them, please like us and spread the word. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be back with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.